President Trump has been abroad all week, but the one country most on the minds of Americans is one he didn't visit, Russia. Craig Gilbert has the latest on Trump's continuing Russia problem. And back home, will Sheriff David Clark Jr. really get that job in Washington? Dan Bice and Mary Spokusa discuss. We'll also have an update on the state budget deliberations and a look back at a conversation earlier this week on immigration. All that and more from the best political team in Wisconsin today on Politics. I'm David Haynes, the opinions editor at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Welcome to On Politics for this Thursday. Well, Donald Trump was abroad all week, but the Russia problem is still around. There were some developments this week. We talked to Craig Gilbert about those. So now I'm joined in studio by Craig Gilbert. And Craig, you were back in town for an announcement this week about Tommy Thompson. We'll get to that in a second. First, I wanted to ask you about President Trump. He's been away on a foreign trip, his first big foreign trip, but this Russia story just doesn't want to go away. We had John Brennan, former CIA director, testifying this week. We had news from the Washington Post that Trump may have tried to lean on a couple of high-level intelligence leaders to say there wasn't collusion between the campaign. What does this mean politically in Washington?
Well, so I think there was some hope on the Republican side that the appointment of Mueller as a special counsel would take a little bit of pressure off this issue. They wouldn't be having to answer questions about it every day. They could point to the fact that there's something like an independent investigation going on. But I think what we saw this week is that there's, there's going to be a continual kind of drip on this story. There's going to be developments with the congressional investigations, which are more public. There are going to be leaks. And then the final wild card is just how President Trump reacts to everything that's going on, whether we see more outbursts on Twitter from him. I mean, he's kind of kept his powder dry this week being abroad. But that's the other wild card in all this, is just how he deals with this issue that's not going away, which is intensely frustrating for
him. Did it help him to be abroad this week?
I think it did a little bit. Yeah. But that doesn't solve his long-term problem. Right. And, a lot of consternation on the part of Republicans going into these midterm elections. There's a lot of wild cards. They're not going to be able to know with any confidence going into the election cycle, how this issue is going to affect them and what shoes are going to drop.
So in the meantime, the budget was released by the Trump administration, and in Congress it appears, as they often do, to be dead on arrival. But there's also this interesting split in the Republican Party now over, we saw it in the health care debate. Are we likely to see that again in the budget debate?
Yeah, I think there is that potential, obviously, between Republican moderates and Republican conservatives, and also between the House and the Senate Republicans. I think there's a sort of fundamental question about the political popularity of the overall kind of Republican approach of some spending austerity and cuts alongside tax cuts that are weighted toward higher income earners. And in the past, Republicans have, in the recent past, they've been able to pass these budgets, but they're political documents. They haven't actually been budgets with teeth because they haven't had the power. And now they have to worry about sort of how these budgets are going to be received if they're actually adopted. And then secondarily, you have the differences and just the challenge, like we saw with health care, of getting the party itself internally to agree on some of these things. And these budgets go much further than even some of the Republican conservative budgets have in the past. And then finally, there's the question of whether the numbers add up. There's a lot of questions about this budget, about how they're accounting for the fiscal impact of the tax cuts and the kind of assumptions they're making about economic growth and what's going to happen to revenues. Big, big questions about that.
And that's sort of the pathway of the budget to eventually getting to tax reform, right?
Exactly. I mean, there's a lot of arcane process issues here that have to do with, to get to step B, you have to go through step A, and that involves passing a budget. We saw that with healthcare too. There's these little windows for legislating, and depending on whether you capture that window or not and get things done on a certain timetable, it affects, the legislative hurdles, how high the bar is, how many votes you need, and what it takes to get it through the House and the Senate.
So let's turn to Tommy Thompson. You're back in town to cover a forum, be a part of a forum there, but there was an announcement this week of a new institute at the UW. Talk about that.
Well, so, you know, it's been 30 years since he was elected governor. He went on to be this dominant figure in Wisconsin politics. So I decided to take a look back at what was so unique about his election track record, especially from the vantage point of today in this very polarized state and this very polarized age that we're living in. His performance among voters outside the Republican base was extraordinary, even by the standards of his own time, but certainly almost surreal by the standards of today, that the numbers he got. There were elections where he was getting large minorities of Democrats and liberals to vote for him, where he was winning the union vote, where he was winning moderates, where he was winning under 30 voters, all these voting groups.
Won the city of Milwaukee.
It's the only time in 70 years a Republican has done that in a race for governor. He won Dane County. Yeah. And then if you look at, you know, African Americans, the worst voting group for Republicans. I mean, Governor Walker, President Trump, they're getting, you know, 1 or 2% in 90% black neighborhoods in the city of Milwaukee. Tommy Thompson gets 25, 26, 27% one year. He gets, you know, double digits another year. That's unheard of today in today's Republican Party. So it's very hard to do, and he probably couldn't do that today. But you know, maybe Republicans can do better than they're doing right now. It takes a strategy and it takes a commitment to a kind of a broader, achieving a broader kind of appeal.
Well, I think you talked about John Kasich in Ohio, who had some success in Ohio in going. Sort
of, and it's not just Republicans. It's an issue for both parties. Yeah. You don't see Democrats doing very well in Waukesha County. Herb Cole won Waukesha County one time, and that's probably not going to happen again for a while. But Tommy Thompson it was his personal ambition to win on blue turf, on enemy turf, and convert voters who don't typically vote Republican. And that was a kind of a precondition for him to having that success.
And the Institute, now what is the Institute going to do at the UW?
Well, I'm not sure. I mean, they're talking about having a speakers program. They're talking about sort of, you know, having a place on campus that will attract a diversity of political views. Obviously, there's kind of a grievance on the right about college campuses favoring discourse on the left. So I think that may be part of what's going on here. But it's just interesting to think about that in light of Tommy Thompson's legacy, which was, again, a different Republican Party at the time and a guy who really transcended the political lines that seem so embedded now.
Craig Gilbert, thanks so much.
Great.
So I'm now joined in studio by Mary Spacuzza, reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, and Dan Bice, a columnist. Dan, let me come to you. Sheriff Clark. Is he our sheriff or not? He announced that he was leaving. The Homeland Security has not confirmed that, and there was some news on a previous incident with Clark just this morning.
Yeah, actually, since he made the announcement, there'd been news, and news, and more news. I wrote today about some of the records that have come out of a lawsuit as a result of a very minor run-in on a flight back on January 15th. There was a guy from River West just getting on a plane, sees Clark. Clark's not wearing his Stetson and looking the way he normally does. He was wearing a Cowboys hat and a Dallas Cowboys sweatshirt because it was the day that the Packers played the Cowboys. And he said, the guy says, his name is Dan Black, said he didn't recognize him, said, "Are you the sheriff?" The sheriff said, "Yes." And they looked at him, and the sheriff said, "You got a problem with that?" The sheriff says Dan Black didn't respond. Dan said he did respond and said, "No, I don't," and then went to the back of the plane. What we got today were the text message in which Sheriff Clark told his staff to get this guy, interview him, and not to arrest him unless he became a jerk about things, and then to ask him, "Why did he say anything to me at all? Why didn't he keep his mouth shut?" And then to follow him out of the airport. We also found out today that the feds, the two assistant U.S. attorneys and an FBI agent looked into this for a possible civil rights violation. They concluded a couple weeks ago not to pursue that, but they said they're open to going back into it if some more information is found out. And we also got the audio and video of the case. Apparently the sheriff also called American Airlines to complain about things, said he had been disrespected on the plane. And then we see five cops and a police dog waiting for Dan Black and the sheriff when they get off the plane, and and then walk them through the airport. So you have all that, and then on top of this, you also have the CNN allegations that the sheriff plagiarized on his master's thesis.
And Mary, talk about what that was all about.
The plagiarism? So this was apparently a paper that he had written where he took broad chunks of other people's work and inserted it into his own paper. It does sound like there were credits or attribution.
Yeah, he cited the stuff. He just
footnotes.
He just didn't put quotes around it. And you know, it's an interesting thing. His he didn't tell anybody he was getting this master's thesis. He just started disappearing for blocks of time. And so I wrote a story saying
it was out in California on the West
Yeah,
Coast.
He was in California. He missed a couple major incidents. He
in the
was
Monterey
gone.
Area, I think.
He was not here when the Sikh temple shooting occurred. Right. He was not here when one of his deputies was killed on the highway because he was out doing work on this. And, you know, he's fought back really hard saying that this isn't plagiarism. Everybody knows who he's quoting. Maybe he didn't do it perfectly. But it's interesting. He says this is the hardest thing he's ever done is writing this master's thesis. So you had that. And then you on
he called
top,
it a political hit, too, and said that
yeah,
it was basically just...
And it's funny, you know, when he gets attacked, he goes after the person personally, as many of us at the Journal Sentinel know, and he went after the reporter pointing out that he didn't have a college degree. So that's sort of standard fare for him. But you also have the issue of that he made this announcement on Vicki McKenna's right. show that he was getting this job with Homeland Security. And we knew that something was up. We've talked on the show about that he would be a liaison to the cop community. And we heard that he was going through a background check. And we knew that people were calling, checking on, making contacts about him. But no one has yet announced that he's gotten this job other than Sheriff Clark. And so
all they've said is tweet that they haven't made an announcement right after he announced that he was getting it. So it does raise questions about
it. So there's all this activity.
Will he be our sheriff still?
He even raised the question about whether this could...
He did on Newsmax.
Possibly.
Newsmax on Monday.
The plagiarism,
on Monday.
Not the plane.
Yeah,
incident.
On Newsmax he said the plagiarism thing could possibly keep him from getting the position and that he wouldn't hold that against Trump if that happened. But, you know, because of his announcement, things are all lining up. You've had Ernell Lucas, who's already announced that he's running. He says he's going to apply for the job as soon as the sheriff submits his resignation letter to the governor, which he's not done. And now you've had Kevin Carr, Sheriff Clark's former number two, say he's also going to apply for the job. And you would have to guess that Sheriff Clark would want Kevin Carr to get the position. But all of these things are happening, and Sheriff Clark is still here.
So no
maybe
official
he'll still
announcement.
Be our sheriff.
Well, no official announcement. So I mean, there are lots of things. So what's the fault from the plagiarism? The place where he got the degree is taking down his thesis and are conducting an investigation. What happens with the plane incident? The lawsuit's going to continue, and we'll see what goes on. There's discovery going on. They're interviewing each of the deputies involved, and I understand they're going to try to depose Sheriff Clark. So that should be interesting. And then we have to wait and see whether this appointment actually comes down.
All right, more to come on that. So we had a community conversation out in Waukesha at Carroll University earlier this week. It's a project that the Journal Sentinel has been embarked on for the last couple of months with Public Radio in Milwaukee, WUWM. And we talked about immigration. Let's play a clip from that conference. From Valeria, help me with her name, Valeria.
We'll just go with Valeria.
Navarro Villegas, who is a recent Marquette grad and a recent immigrant, 17 years to the day of the conference.
So we came to Milwaukee on May 22nd, 2000, exactly 17 years ago. So it's a big day for me today. And I see myself in the situation where I understand that it was an illegal decision to just cross the border, but I also see my parents' struggles, and I remember living in the poverty that we experienced. Like my mom used to always tell us, we don't have a messy house because we only have one pair of shoes each. And she brought us here in hopes that education was going to liberate us from those hardships, and she didn't want us to have a life that she had. She was married at 21 She had me at 22. By the time she was 28, she had the three of us with not enough money to keep a family moving forward. So she pushed and pushed, and eventually, I got to college. In 2011, I started at Marquette University. I had a lot of struggles getting through college. It was economically hard, and emotionally and psychologically, with how our state is. But I finished yesterday, and my parents' sacrifices and dreams became a reality as I crossed the stage last night.
So, Mary, Valeria's story is really quite a tale of coming to this country. And she is quite a success story now. She's graduated from Marquette. She's applying to law school.
Graduated pre-med and Latin America. I think it was Spanish language, yeah. Literature, and culture, and pre-med double major, yeah.
But quite an interesting discussion. And I heard a number of people say in the audience, we had about 150 people there out at Carroll, that, gosh, couldn't we have this discussion on the federal level, a thoughtful discussion? Good question.
Yeah, that is a good question. All the panelists were very impressive. I think Valeria was a tough act to follow. Her personal stories about crossing the border at age 7 and the coyotes throwing away all their belongings, including her favorite toy, was pretty heartbreaking.
Threatening her 2-year-old sister.
Yes, and getting in a car. The woman who was driving them, they get in a car thinking maybe a woman would be nicer to them. And it's a 7-year-old, a 5-year-old, a 2-year-old, 2 women, and the driver tells them that she has guns and will shoot them if they make any noise. And the 2-year-old and the 5-year-old promptly start bawling out of scare, out of fear, and threatening to shoot a 2-year-old. She was very impressive. I thought the Racine sheriff was also very thoughtful and talked quite a bit about, from his perspective, he obviously was just representing himself, but saying that the reason they're not doing the 287G program, which is the, having deputies getting more involved in immigration enforcement, was because of staffing concerns that he was saying, basically, we have a job to do to protect public safety, and the federal government needs to take care of its federal problems, and we don't have the manpower to essentially work as immigration agents.
Sheriff Clark has said he wants to do that.
Right. Yeah. Quite a difference from Sheriff Clark. He really didn't want to comment on any other sheriffs or Sheriff Clark or anyone else and their decisions, but from his perspective, that is not what his main mission is, and that is not something they have the time or the money or the staffing to do.
Right now, no other jurisdiction in Wisconsin does that. It's I think it's about 30 places around the country to have, but some have pulled back, like Houston said it was costing them too much money and just dropped the program.
And like many programs, he will, if there's a detainer from ICE or from another agency, they will hold that person and ICE will come and get them. But it's not that he's basically saying that they're not doing immigration checks on every person that they come across.
So I should point out, Mary was one of the moderators. Thank you for doing that.
Our panelists were good. They made our jobs easy.
Along with Mitch Teich from Public Radio. So we will be doing more Across the Divide sessions. We're going to take the summer off, but come back in the fall. Mm-hmm. So look for more information on that. So the state budget is still a work in progress. I talked to Patrick Marley about where that's headed. Well, Patrick, welcome to On Politics.
Thank you.
So earlier this week, the Republicans were so divided on the state budget issue about the tuition cut for UW that they couldn't come to a vote and they had to delay it. We've seen that as a kind of a pattern so far. Where are we at now? Are we likely to see a vote on that issue? And where are we at on some of the other issues facing the legislature?
Sure. Republicans have complete control of state government, but they're moving pretty slow with the budget. There's some real divisions between the Republicans who control the legislature and the governor. There's some real divisions within the Republican ranks in the legislature on these issues, and so that sort of came to a head on Tuesday. They were going to consider Governor Walker's plan to cut tuition by 5% at UW schools for residents. The Assembly didn't want to go along with that. The Senate didn't know what it wanted to do. This is before the Budget Committee, and so they held off. At the end of the day, Alberta Darling, she's the senator who co-chairs the committee, said that they would try to come back today. We'll see if that would happen. I checked yesterday with some leadership, and it sounded like that was likely to come up today. My feeling is that they're unlikely to go along with the tuition cut, but we'll see how that plays out. But it sort of speaks to a broader issue here of some real differences among Republicans and a little trouble making a lot of headway on the budget.
So what are the other major issues that remain to be decided?
Sure. Well, I guess we'll start with something where there seems to be some agreement on. Today, they will also be taking up some changes to public benefits programs that would require drug testing or at least drug screening to see if you need to be tested for public benefits. Also, some more work requirements to receive public benefits. These are things that Republicans are largely in agreement on. I think we'll see them accept what the governor has proposed to expand this. This would also require sign-off from the federal government with President Trump in charge. That's much more likely for the feds to accept that than it would have been under President Obama. And these are things that Democrats fiercely oppose. They see it as hurdles and stigmatizing of the poor. So that's an area where there's some agreement, at least with the party that's in control. In terms of divisions, transportation continues to be the big hang-up that they're having, and certainly property taxes now have emerged as a problem. The governor said the other day on Twitter that he would veto the entire budget if property taxes go up in this budget. We've never seen him make a threat to his fellow Republicans like that before about vetoing the entire budget. He was in with Assembly Republicans for an hour yesterday, talking behind closed doors. It does not sound like they made a lot of progress or reached any agreements in that meeting.
Well, I've been struck, too, by the use of Twitter during the budget debate.
Yeah.
A couple of times that's happened, right, with the governor taking to Twitter to sort of scold his fellow Republicans.
It has. He's using it as a medium to get his message out. I suppose you can compare it to Trump. He's not quite as strongly worded as the president is, but he's certainly harnessing the power of Twitter to stake out his position. It is frustrating some Republican lawmakers who feel like it's not a way to negotiate. They'd rather have more of these meetings like they did yesterday where they can talk face-to-face. Republican lawmakers are also frustrated with the governor. They feel that he keeps moving the goalposts. They think they have one understanding of what he wants on transportation or what he wants on property taxes, only to learn later that he wants something a little bit different than what they expected.
Well, he hasn't called Robin Voss low energy yet, so I guess
right.
we'll keep waiting. Patrick Marley in Madison, thanks so much for that report.
Yeah, thanks, Dave.
So now we're back for winners and losers. And Mary, let me turn to you first. Who's your winner this week?
I'm going to go with somebody on the East Coast, Christine Pellegrino. She is the New York Democrat who, in an upset, won in a district that I think Republicans have maybe a 16-point lead typically, and Trump won in fall. And a lot of Democrats are, looking at that news and hoping that they might be able to flip some seats and that, things will not be
Montana
a smooth sailing
Georgia.
For
yeah.
Republicans in the near future.
So an early look. And
that was a state race, but, it was. Yeah. So I think they're eyeing that as a sign of things to come.
Right. And maybe another sign of things to come in your loser. Who's your loser?
I'm going to go with Greg Gianforte just because he's the one who apparently body slammed a reporter from The Guardian. Not only did it, but did it in front of a Fox News crew that was all watching, apparently in horror.
Who vouched for the reporter's
right.
story.
Who vouched for the reporter's story and said, it sounds like he maybe grabbed him by the neck by both hands and slammed him to the ground and punched him a couple times.
Weirdest part of that story was, so he gets slammed to the ground, he pops up, he says, you did whatever. He asked the Fox News guys for their names. Did you see what they did? They wouldn't give him his name.
Oh, really?
They said they were in shock. So they refused to give their names, but then they finally post about the thing. So it was just weird, that sort of thing. But I'm sure he's thinking, are they with me? Are they not with me? Whatever.
Did you see what just happened? You're going to tell him what you saw, right? But,
And there was the BuzzFeed guy in the next door who sort of saw
part of it.
Right.
And saw, I think they said they saw his feet go flying in the air, and they didn't see what happened, but they could see him hitting the ground.
And some people, some Republicans have gone against him. And it's, was it three newspapers withdrawn endorsements already?
Yeah. And the idea was he's being asked about the new report on the health care law, and I think it was probably people being uninsured, people ending up uninsured. But it does not sound...
Who would also be losers this week.
There you go. Yes, also those folks, which we'll have to talk about more in the near future. But it does not sound like it was... It does not sound like it was a intensely attacking personal, you know, like it doesn't sound like he was, and I guess they're trying to say he was aggressively asking his questions and shoving his, you know, tape
from
recorder
the audio
phone
I heard,
in his
he certainly
face.
Followed up. I mean, he told him, go see my press guy, and he followed up. And
it's then, nothing that I haven't done.
It's nothing any of us have
and
done.
And the thing
as
is, like,
reporters.
We're supposed to be persistent and ask questions right. and but try to avoid people dodging
the
questions.
Interesting thing is that there are 700,000 registered voters there, and 200,000 have already voted.
Right.
So maybe as many as 50% have already voted before this incident occurred. So
the chances of it having much impact on that race.
I mean, it could.
It just, I mean, it sounds like he might win anyway, and there are a lot of people did early voting, and some people probably aren't going to change their votes over that. And it might be something that reporters care more about than everybody, but I think that's, you should be able to keep it cool. You've had other incidents
involving reporters where it's, in North Carolina you did, and a couple other, in New York you did, incidents between candidates and reporters that actually the candidate ends up losing. I think whether it's a reporter or anybody else, you don't want your candidate body slamming people just days before an election.
Generally not.
Plus, he comes across very badly on the audio.
I'm thinking I could start teaching martial arts to political reporters and meld my two interests.
So you had the national. I get the local.
Okay, so who's
my
loser?
My losers are Hector Colon and other members of Chris Abley's cabinet. The county board is going to be rescinding their pay raises possibly today. And for Hector, I think it's a $54,000 a year pay cut, which is right around what the average pay is for someone in Wisconsin. So a major pay cut, other people getting $20,000-$25,000 pay cuts as well. The tension between the county board and Abley continues to be very real. It's not dissipated any in recent years.
And who's your winner?
My winner is a story Bill Glauber did on Wisconsin Avenue and Steve Marcus putting up a number of art projects along there. I'm a big fan of public art. They're just installing some of it now, but it'll be there throughout the summer.
Right, and they look great. So let's go to a couple of viewer questions. Dan, let me give you the first one here. Pretty straightforward. Who's going to win the Democratic Party chair race this weekend?
I was very wrong a couple times ago, so remember that, and I'm terrible at predicting elections, but I'm going to guess that Martha Lanning, the current chair. She's being opposed by a couple of people, but primarily by Brian Kennedy, the Glendale mayor, who's, you know, it's easy to run against Martha Lanning because the Democrats have not done well in recent elections. She also got a bonus. We're not sure exactly why she got a bonus shortly after the election last year because there wasn't much to celebrate. But at the same time, you know, he's mayor of Glendale, former teachers union boss, but didn't do so well when he ran for Congress against Congressman Sensenbrenner. So,
all right. And Mary, let me give you this one. This is regarding a Craig Gilbert story, but it says that the writer says that he thinks Paul Ryan is spot on in noting that the speaker seemed to acknowledge that the investigations of the Trump administration by Congress is going to keep Congress occupied for a long time. Do you think that is the Democrats' intent?
I will start out by saying I don't think Democrats will be upset if this goes on for a long time. I think that they will be happy to learn more and talk more about this. At the same time, I think it's a bit, it would be misleading to imply that Democrats are the ones leading the charge on this investigation. This is a, you know, FBI, federal intelligence agencies seem to have started looking into this months ago and have actually found things that led them to continue the investigation. Mm-hmm. And it seems like there were and are serious questions, and we have not really heard We haven't heard somebody definitively say there was collusion, but we haven't heard somebody say that there wasn't either.
The Democratic Party didn't appoint the special prosecutor.
Right, and now we have a special prosecutor, Robert Mueller, former head of the FBI, who's sort of in charge of the main investigation.
Right, and then the Comey issue of before he was fired, it seemed like Trump was pressuring him to wrap up the investigation, say that he's not under investigation, let Flynn off easy, saying that he's a nice guy. So I think that there are things that have raised concern, and I'm sure if Hillary Clinton had gotten elected and there were allegations that Russia had helped her, Republicans would be very curious about that, and probably some Democrats too.
Curious.
Yes.
I'd be curious.
I'd be curious.
All right, time for one more. Dan, this is yours. What's the purpose of the articles about the Bradley Foundation? About all the good things that they're doing to give money to conservative causes. Are you saying that giving money to conservative causes is not good?
Oh, that would be terrible. No, what we're doing is the records at the Bradley Foundation were hacked last year. We've been given access to those hacked records. And what it's been is a window into what they've done. And you know, many of us who are aware of the Bradley Foundation still think of it in terms of its 90s vision, which is primarily a policy-driven institute focused on school choice and welfare reform. But what the records have shown us is they've actually moved from policy to process. They're very engaged in getting their ideas into reality, and that means setting up a what we've called a conservative infrastructure in Wisconsin and in other states. Mm-hmm. In addition to that, they've moved their policy much further beyond those two issues. We had a story that's already run on climate change and how they've become very interested in, and funded a number of people on climate change. We'll have
people questioning whether climate change is affected by human activity.
And actually, Mary and I are going to be writing a story about their positions and their activity on family-related issues coming up. And there are any number of other issues that they branched out into, particularly now that they have a new CEO. So, no, we're just trying to tell you about this billion-dollar institution that's in our backyard, what they're doing, and how it's changed over the years.
And what a major player they are, too. I think a lot of people know of the Koch brothers and don't know the, you know, massive influence that the Bradley Foundation here in Milwaukee has and has continued to have and will continue to have.
And you can see the Koch brothers, there's not any sort of collusion or anything, but you can see the Koch brothers are very much focused on the campaign process, helping out candidates, getting them elected, spending money in campaigns. The Bradley Foundation is interested in the results of campaigns, but are much more emphasized on the operations of government, how to influence it, and how to get their ideas and agenda enacted in that way. So while one works on, you know, the institution of government, the other one works on the institution of campaigns.
Bradley's been really focused on states, right?
They used to be. You know, when Michael Joyce ran it in the 80s and 90s, he was very much interested in federal government stuff. He funded the Federalist Society, the Heritage Foundation, the American Enterprise Institute. It's under Mike Grebe that since about 2010, that I think they decided, probably some frustration with the Obama administration, they decided the way to go was to shift the focus to the states. And, you know, that's been not just their platform, but the Republican platform as well. And now coincides with what the Trump administration is saying. Yeah. We need to move Medicaid back to the states. Well, the thing is, when that happens, the Bradley Foundation already has a system set up to try to encourage people to do certain things with those policies.
Okay. Well, we'll have to leave it there. Dan Bice, thank you. And Mary Spacuzza, thanks for being with us. Also, thanks to Craig Gilbert, our Washington correspondent, and Patrick Marley in Madison. I'm Dave Haynes with the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Thanks for watching.